This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Baseball Outside the Box. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. We're going to have another great show today. This is a show where we bring you the most innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds that love to challenge the status quo. And we are on with the Lineup Media Group. Don't forget to go to their website, lineupmediagroup.fm. I want to thank Andrew on the other side of the window with the Lineup Media Group. He is the producer today. And we are going to get started. Before we do, don't forget, check out the social media. We got a lot of great information, videos, tips, you name it. You can even ask us questions. Go to our Facebook, facebook.com/baseballoutsidethebox. Check out our Twitter at baseballout. If you go to our website and you're a current listener that you've been listening to the show for a long time, we want to thank you. If you're a new listener, join the show. Just go to Stitcher, iTunes. When you join the show, you get great updates on the shows. You know when the next show's coming up. You don't even have to check it out. It automatically sends you a message. And if you love the show, give us a 5-star rating. That helps it, you know, keep the show going. If you don't like the show, let us know. We like to get a lot of feedback. We're trying to get better at this, and you can do that by emailing me directly, and I will get back to you right away. info@baseballoutsidethebox.com. Love getting your emails. They could be baseball questions. They can be anything about the show. So do that, and we'd appreciate it. All right, now, today's show, it's an exciting one. Why? We've got one of the best coaches. I'm talking about coaches, managers, mentors in the game, anywhere in the world. He is outstanding. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him, and I'll tell you the topic, and we'll get started. And his name is Jerry Weinstein. Jerry co-authored Baseball's Coach's Survival Guide, Practical Techniques and Materials for Building an Effective Program and a Winning Team. You've got to get this. It is outstanding. Now, his career in coaching and managing is, I mean, we could be here for hours. So I'm going to make it a little quick synopsis, and then you can go to our show notes and check it out. But he has done everything. I see him as a mentor to coaches in the U.S. and all over the world. He's a student of the game. And as long as he's been coaching, he still studies the game daily. It's unbelievable. He's a great example, role model for a lot of coaches. Started his coaching career in 1966 at UCLA as a freshman coach. He was also at the University of Miami when they went to the College World Series. He served as the Dodgers development director from 2000 to 2001. He then coached at Sacramento City College. He had 831 wins across 23 seasons, led the California Community College Athletic Association state title in 88 and 98. Then went on, I mean, just incredible. Colorado Rockies, he was a bench coach with the Colorado Rockies in the big leagues in 2012. He's also served, he represented our country. One of the greatest things you can do, represent our country on Team USA in the 92 Summer Olympics, coached Team USA in the 96 Summer Olympics. He was there with Skip Bergman when they won the bronze medal. He coached Team USA to a gold in the 2005. I hope I don't mispronounce this, Maccabi Games, but he's going to tell me in a minute because I think I mispronounced and I apologize. Jerry Weinstein managed then the Israeli team in the 2017 World Baseball Classic qualifier where they went perfect 3-0 and then qualified for the Classic last year. He returned as the head coach. They played in the World Baseball Classic. I was fortunate enough to be there. What an outstanding job. They went on from the first round, went on to the second round from South Korea, went on to Japan for the second round. He's in the Hall of Fame for Sacramento City College. That's the Athletic Hall of Fame. And he's in the best Hall of Fame you could be in, the American Baseball Coaches Association. So, again, we are thrilled to have Jerry on the phone. Jerry, I want to welcome you. How you doing, my friend?
Doing well, Pete. Good to be here.
Glad to have you, because I'll tell you what, one of the things I believe in strongly is, you know, development of coaches. And I don't know if there's a better person that is a better role model when it comes to developing coaches, whether it's here in the U.S. I know you've also done for the International Sports Group, our group, you've done so many coaching seminars around the world. You're so well known, and you've helped a lot of coaches. You just love to help people, I can tell. So we're thrilled to have you on your show. The first thing I want to ask you right away, get started. You've got this, I guess manual you call it, or it's called The Practical Techniques and Materials for Building an Effective Program and a Winning Team. Tell us a little bit about it, and then we'll get into some of the questions.
Well, that's kind of an old publication. I did that maybe 20 years ago, maybe even a little bit longer at Sacramento City College. It's somewhat outdated today. My recent one is Complete Handbook of Coaching Catchers, which is 3 or 4 years old. It's a really detailed, comprehensive manual on coaching catchers, and that's the one that's probably the most current.
You know, and matter of fact, I've seen that several times, and what we're going to do is we're going to take and put the website up on our show notes, and I believe the website is coachingcatchers.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's coachingcatchers.com, and that's got all the information on it, and, I'm not very entrepreneurial. I don't push materials and stuff like that, but we've sold a fair number of books and gotten good feedback on it. And it's a book that I like. I think it has value for catchers at all levels, from the very beginning catcher to the big league catcher as well.
Well, you know what? You know, we're going to place our show notes. We think, you know, and I know you personally, I've seen your work, you know, I just think you're one of the best in the business, so I'm going to keep promoting all your stuff on our website, and also every coach we talk to. So, you know, we could talk a little catching also, since we're on this, since you got the coaching part. Let's start off with a little catching, and then what we'll do is we'll get into some of the coaching philosophies of a winning team that you feel are important. But let's start with the catching part. You know, everybody says the catcher's the leader. Give us your philosophy on, what kind of person are you looking for in a catcher? What should coaches look for in a catcher? And, you know, where does the development start with catchers?
Well, it starts with making sure you have an athlete behind the plate. And that was not always the case, but if you really analyze things, for me, your two best athletes need to be your pitcher and your catcher, because they handle the ball more than anybody else. And the catcher really impacts the pitcher on a per pitch basis. He's the guy that when you play a game, there's three guys that are going to determine whether you win or lose: the pitcher, catcher, and the umpire. And the catcher impacts both the pitcher and the umpire. But I think that one of the undersold physical traits of the catcher is athleticism, and you have to have athleticism, because there's multi-dimensional demands of catching: strength, quickness, agility, flexibility, great eye-hand coordination. You really have to be athletic, and the kind of guy you're. And then not even to mention the mental side of the game. You need an intelligent guy. You need a real perceptive, lifelong learner. He needs to be a psychologist, but he also needs to be creative. He needs to be a thinker. He needs to be a great preparer. You know, kind of you're looking for that crossover. The corollary is, you know, the quarterback in football, or the middle linebacker, or the point guard in basketball. I like people that have played multiple sports that are athletic and also are intelligent. So, you know, there's a lot of traits that are important when you start thinking about athletes that are smart and leaders. We could take the whole show and talk individually about each trait that's important.
Sure. And, you know, what's interesting is when you said, you know, leaders about catchers, and, you know, when you're talking about developing a club, you know, if you're a high school coach, sometimes you get what you get, obviously, because, you know, the kids are in high school, and you don't always get to pick your players. So if you've got two catchers, according to what you're saying, one of the criteria you're looking for is the kid that's really sharp, that's studious, can think on his own, let's say. That's the type of catcher you're looking for. Well, let's say you kind of don't have a really sharp kid, but you're stuck with that one kid. Can you develop some of that?
Well, you can develop anything. That's what the teaching and coaching is about, changing behavior and changing the thinking of your players and the choices that they make. So we very rarely get ready-made catchers that are dropped in our venue. no matter what, even if they're a big league catcher, they're continuing to learn and develop. You never stop development. If you're looking for that guy that just, you know, perfectly fits into that round peg, it just doesn't happen. You have to spend time to develop that individual.
And you notice the one of the big questions, you see it on social media a lot, you see it just in general conversations at coaching clinics, and there's very different philosophies on this, and I'd love to get yours. And I think you might know where I'm going at, and that's calling games, whether at the high school or college, or even when you're starting off when you're younger. What's your philosophy? When do we start kids to, you know, even though you might have a 12-year-old that they're just throwing a fastball and maybe a slower pitch, that's only two pitches and locations, but when's the time to really get them to start on, you know, calling games on their own?
Well, I think it's a process. I think first, you know, obviously, you know, maybe they need some direction from the coach. And it's very simple with young kids. Basically, you have to establish fastballs down over the middle of the plate. That would be the first thing they learn. So it's, we're not over analyzing or overcooking the situation. But as you go and you're dealing with, certainly the number one priority as a catcher is to pitch call to the pitcher's strengths. And you have to learn that. That's an ongoing process. You have to learn what your pitcher's strengths are. And, you know, basically young catchers, when they go behind the plate, that's the farthest thing from their mind. They're just trying to defend themselves and figure out how to stay in front of balls in the dirt, because the natural reaction is to get out of the way and figuring out how just to catch the ball before it stops rolling. The pitch calling is very secondary. Game management is very secondary with young guys. But yeah, even if you – and I'm not opposed to coaches calling pitches. But part of the process is you have to – if you're doing that, then there has to be a process, a review process, an after-action analysis, like after the game. Well, here's why I did this. This is my thinking here. And then you kind of – slowly hand the reins over to the catcher, because the catcher ultimately has the best feel for that pitcher, because he's catching every pitch. He sees the action of the pitch. He has a good feel for this guy's ability to hit his target. So that ultimately you want to put it in the hands of the catcher. That doesn't mean that in certain situations, based on maybe your better knowledge of the scouting report, which shouldn't be the case, and in the big leagues it isn't, because catchers really prepare, you might suggest a pitch. And again, when catchers call pitches, they are basically suggesting a particular pitch to the pitcher. Ultimately, the responsibility as to what pitch is thrown, it should be on the shoulders of the pitcher. He shouldn't just follow the catcher 100%. He's got to throw the pitch that he has confidence in. There's not just one pitch, and there's a long option line of pitches that can be thrown in given situations. Usually you get beat not by the wrong pitch. It's poorly executed. That's 9 times out of 10. That's what does you in. And so the so-called wrong pitch thrown with confidence is much better than the right pitch thrown with doubt. So it's basically up to the pitcher to figure out what pitch he wants. And ultimately, if they're both on thinking the same way, that's even better. But that doesn't happen every day. And ultimately, we need to put the responsibility back on the pitcher for the pitch. And then it's his responsibility to execute the pitch as best he can.
Yeah, and that's what I'm wondering, at a certain point, even other than pitch count, you mentioned, that catchers, obviously, you want the kids that are smart that think on their own. And I love to hear that, because my question is going to be is when, and I know it's a difficult one because it depends on the players and the individual player, but there's a certain point where, you want catchers, I would assume, like you said, think on their own a little bit. So when is the time when they're all of a sudden now they're able to call pickoffs, or maybe they're able to call pitch outs, because maybe they see something in front of them that somebody in the dugout didn't see?
Well, I think it's very individualized. Not all the fruit gets ripe at the same time. Some kids are more ready at 9, 10, 11 years old because of watching a lot of games or being in an environment, a high-intensity coaching, teaching environment where they're exposed to a lot of different things, and depending upon their passion for the game and how much time they're willing to spend and how productive it is in terms of looking at the right things and understanding the game within the game. I don't think you can say there's any one time for any one individual. I think it varies, but I think by the time kids get to high school and by the time they're the junior or senior year, they should be able to manage a ball game. I think, you know, that's one of the big criteria for me. You know, receiving is number one, blocking is number two. Maybe game management comes even before throwing, but managing the game and managing a pitching staff is very, very important. Because any given day, I talk to pitchers and catchers. I said, when we win, catcher gets half a win, pitcher gets half a win. When we lose, catcher gets half a loss, pitcher gets half a loss. It's a tandem, kind of a symbiotic endeavor that they're working together. And the better they work together, not only during the game, but in between innings, during their side work, during their flat ground work, the relationship and the trust that they develop, you know, you have to work at that, because when you throw a finger down there, that pitcher has to understand that that you're prepared for this situation and that you're just not randomly flipping stuff down there. You know, it's called smart fingers, and the guys that prepare best have, you know, at least they have a reason for doing it based on the scouting report or the positioning or the pitcher's ability to hit his target or execute a particular pitch. Or it might even be a development environment where, hey, we're going to throw this breaking ball here because we've got some wiggle room in the ball game, and this is a good time for you to throw it in the game so that you can develop that pitch so we can use it later in the game or later in the season. Ultimately, you know, that game management piece becomes increasingly more important at the higher levels that you play.
Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I love what you said at the beginning of the show when you mentioned, you know, pitchers and catchers being, you know, so vital, probably one of the most vital parts of a team, because they're always handling the ball, both of them. And, you know, obviously you've had a lot of experience at this, and just recently, you know, your coaching staff have done a great job along with the organization, with the Israeli national team and the World Baseball Classic and the qualifiers. When you took on the classic team and you had pitchers and then you have catchers, give our audience a little bit of an idea. And I know you know the opposing teams a little bit because you've got video and you've got it's not like a high school coach where they don't see the teams very often. But give us an idea how you laid out a plan to attack the hitters, with your pitchers and catchers, how that works.
Well, the number one piece of the plan is the strengths and weaknesses of your pitcher. You got to pitch to your pitcher's strengths, and that would always be number one. And you got a great fastball hitter, and this guy is a fastball pitcher. Well, we're throwing fastballs. We're not asking him to do something that he can't do. Ideally, we're throwing him within the hitter's swing zone and outside his solid contact zone. Now, my contention has always been that you get fastball hitters out with fastballs. With that being said, we did have exceptionally good scouting reports on all our teams. We had Ben Worthen from the Orioles, and we had Alex Jacobs, who was with the Diamondbacks now. Mm-hmm. And they spent hour upon hour upon hour over a period of months preparing scouting reports on every team that we played. And that was a big factor in our success, because we had experience. One of the things we had were veteran pitchers. Now, we didn't have that, maybe that upper level number one type, but we had a number of guys that we could mix and match with who could execute a scouting report, and they had broad-based skills basically they could throw more than one pitch for a strike. They could change speed. They could pitch up in the zone. They could throw down below the zone in chase situations. They had, not only did they have command, but they had enough quality to their repertoire that they could really execute a scouting report. And we always had good info. So the combination of those two components allowed us to be successful.
Give us a little inside look into that clubhouse. Did you have, were there team meetings prior to games? And how does that kind of sound?
Yeah, I'm a meeting guy, and players don't like a lot of meetings, but we would meet in small groups. We had, we spent a lot of time with our pitchers and catchers. Everybody had an individualized scouting report. We'd have meetings before the game was, all the games. We didn't have necessarily a group of starting pitchers. Everything was staffed. We knew that what our matchups would be and how we would change pitchers based on the situation, scoreboard, and where they were in the batting order. We wanted we looked at every situation as a leverage situation. So we tried to adapt between left, right-handers, soft, hard, breaking ball pitchers, fastball guys, that were best equipped to pitch in a particular situation. So, we used four or five pitchers every game based on the situation. And, bringing a group together and having them together for a very short period of time is difficult. And so we did a lot of stuff before they got there in terms of putting in, a very simplified bunt defensive situation, all our basic defensive situations, first and third, cutoffs and relays, pop-up priority, and then we did, in our preparation, the time that we had to prepare for the tournament, which was down in Scottsdale, we did a lot of work on basic fundamentals. Obviously, we had to get them ready to the speed of the game in terms of batting practice and ground balls and stuff like that. But we also spent a lot of time on just really basic fundamentals. And in going into Asia, we were playing on very different artificial surface fields. One of them had ceramic pellets rather than the sand, typical sand and rubber. So that field was incredibly fast in Seoul, Korea, and the one in Tokyo was not quite as fast, but different environments. And so we had to spend a lot of time on cutoffs and relays at the venue and pop-up priority and, just some very basic stuff so that we wouldn't get taken advantage of.
Sure. Jerry, we've got a lot of coaches that listen that are around the world, and there's going to be variables here because we're going to have some, youth coaches, we've got travel coaches, we've got in-house, high school, college. When we're talking about, because I think it's important, when we're talking about, a plan against a hitter, let's take a team that doesn't see that their opposing team that often. Are there any tips you can give our coaches on what they can do to kind of identify the hitter? Where are they going to do it if they don't have the video and all the equipment that some of us are lucky to have?
Well, pitching is a very liquid endeavor. Everything is one pitch at a time based on how I executed that pitch, how the hitter reacted to that pitch, and where I feel the hitter's attention zone was going on the next pitch. Now, certainly with less experienced hitters, there's no predicting where young kids, what their thinking is going to be like or what their swing is going to be like from pitch to pitch. But with more experienced guys, that determines what the next pitch is going to be. For example, let's say I throw a guy a breaking ball and he has a real bad swing at it and I execute it just the way I want to. Do I feel like he's going to adjust and be more opposite field centered and looking down for the breaking ball and maybe his timing is set for the breaking ball? Is he ready? Is it time for us to throw a fastball belt line in? Or do I feel like the swing was so mistimed that I can come back and go soft again? And so a lot of decision making is on the fly. But also, for me, having a basic plan, a basic pitching plan, and always in college and even in professional baseball, we had a basic plan, and it was it was pretty simple, and it applied to every hitter in every situation, but it was more pitcher oriented. First pitch strikes, really, really great big emphasis on first pitch strikes. 93% of first pitch strikes are either outs or taken for strikes. 7% of the first pitch strikes are hits. And so getting ahead in the count, and then we talk about the importance of of throwing two of the first three pitches for strikes. That was our number two goal. First pitch strikes, and then two of three. And then pay close attention to the 1-1, 2-0, and 2-1 pitch, because those are the three big swing pitches relative to changing the situation into hitter leverage or pitcher leverage. You know, everybody talks about the 1-1 pitch, but if you look at the OPS on base plus slugging swing between 2-0 and 3-0 or 2-0 and 2-1 or 2-1 and 3-1 or 2-1 and 2-2, it's even more than the 1-1 to 1-2 or 2-1. So when we say pay close attention to that count, we're talking about throwing our highest percentage strike pitch or pitches to our highest percentage location in those counts. Now, ideally, we have a speed variance of 10 plus miles an hour between the two pitches that we're throwing, so we can control the end speed of the hitter's bat and the hitter's timing. Because when hitters hit, they're on time. When they don't hit, they're not on time. And then we talk about treating the 2-2 pitch like a 3-2 pitch. And then finally, we talk about creating uncomfortable at-bats. And uncomfortable at-bats are created by three things. One, a high percentage strike percentage. When you're throwing strike after strike after strike with the goal being 70-plus percent strikes. The other thing that creates uncomfortable at-bats is your ability to pitch inside for strikes. And when I talk about inside, I talk about belt line and above for strikes. And then also pitch in off the plate between the plate and the hitter, where the hitter has to move his feet because hitters don't like that. So those three things create uncomfortable at-bats. So those are the six tenets of our basic plan. And that would be our basic plan that is adjustable based on how the pitch was thrown, how the hitter reacted to the pitch, and where I thought the hitter was going to go on the next pitch.
You know, I love that. That's a great message to all the coaches around the world, because it really sounds like, as I'm listening to you talk, it sounds like you take care of your business, what you need to do, and then make an adjustment if you have to make one, instead of worrying about only what the hitter's doing. I love to hear that. And now I'm going to flip it a little bit, go to the pitcher again, only because, you know, the game itself, and I know you're a constant learner, and that's what I love about you. The game itself, they say it's evolving, but I think sometimes it's coming back around in a circle, and I'll tell you why. And the question is going to be this. You're seeing more and more younger teams going to multiple pitchers in a game. They also seen in the major leagues a little bit in the playoffs when they're bringing, you know, their relief pitchers in a little earlier or their closers in a little earlier. What's your philosophy about? Because I remember when I was at Mickey Owen Baseball School as a young coach, you know, I would always use 3-4 pitchers depending, because I'd give a kid a chance to pitch to so many hitters just to give them the feel of being in the game, being part of the team. What's your philosophy of using 3-4 pitchers a game and not just a starter and maybe a closer?
Well, if you have the depth, now a lot of teams don't have the depth. They might have 5 or 6 pitchers total on their team, and of those 5 or 6, maybe 2 or 3 get the ball over the plate. So, unless you're in a total developmental mode, which is not a bad thing, especially in the off season, that you can do that. But if you have the numbers, I think that what we're seeing now, and we see it more in the playoffs, because, you know, short series, which the WC was a short series too. And so it's all about creating favorable matchups. But I also think that you develop the depth of your pitching staff. Like, guys don't have to throw 100 pitches to develop their pitch ability. And probably the more times that they're out there with proper rest, the more development occurs. And then also the less wear and tear on the arm as well. And so I think that, we don't see it during – it doesn't work as well over a 162-game schedule, because of the wear and tear on the bullpen is – their preparation is more as sprinters. You know, they're not long distance guys, and the throwing that they do to prepare for their outing is basically the loads aren't enough to create the type of arm that can throw two or three in two, maybe one, two or three innings every other day. That's just over the course of a season, they'd be toast. And so the regular season changes a little bit. But for teams that have pitching depth, I think that, number one, you really create problems. You know, if I have a pitcher that I really know and I'm playing a team that I don't know, or if I have a great scouting report on a team and I don't know my pitcher very well, I'd much rather know my pitcher than know the other team. And it's the same for hitters. You have a great scouting report on an outstanding pitcher that you've seen a lot, or you've seen maybe a little lesser guy, or you're playing against a little lesser guy that you haven't seen, advantage that pitcher that you haven't seen. So that's why a lot of times when young pitchers come up to the big leagues and hitters haven't seen them a lot, they have more problems with them. And I mean, I think you saw it in this year's World Series, where Kenley Jansen was less effective later in the series because they had seen him a lot. And so they were, you know, they knew what his release point was going to be like. They knew what his slider looked like. They knew what his cut fastball looked like. They knew where it started and where it was going to end up. And so I think the greater advantage to the hitter when they've seen a pitcher more. And that's why when you know, the analytics stuff, and most of this is directed towards third time through the lineup. They try and keep hitters from seeing the pitcher the third time through the lineup. And by more of a staff mentality, depending upon the quality of the pitcher, and certainly in professional baseball, the quality of every pitcher is pretty good. So advantage pitching.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Jerry, tell me you've been in the game a long time. Where do you see the game going right now as far as development? The changes, are they good, bad, indifferent? You know, give us an idea of, because you've been in it a long time. Where are we going with the game now?
Well, I think we're going in a great direction for me. I might be in the minority of the old guard, but we're finally quantifying what's going on. I think that we have gut feeling and intuition as to, you know, what's right, but now we can really quantify it with video and all the analytics. Mm-hmm. And all the analysis tools that you have and all the wearable technology. And I think that, this is a fact-based endeavor now. We're not just, it's not anecdotal. Well, you know, I remember when I did this but now we can really, we can really quantify what we're doing with the Modus Leave and with TrackMan and with the Rep Soto and guys are understanding the value of spin axis and spin rate and really when we start instruction, we can get legitimate feedback, and it's not just based on, well, what it looks like. Now I can really put a number on it and quantify it.
What does Jerry Weinstein do to make himself better? As a coach, manager, instructor, as a person, you know, what do you do daily?
Oh, I read a lot. I do a lot of reading. I read, I usually have two books going at once. A lot of reading. I spend a lot of time on different websites that I look at that I think have good information. You know, it's surprising how much great information there is out there on the web right now. Good baseball stuff and some not so good, but you usually get something from everybody.
Sure. And I noticed just recently, yesterday, I think it was, I got a message on either Twitter or one of the social medias. You might've read an article and you sent it out. You said, this is and you explained why it's good. I don't know how you do it, because I don't know how much, you know, how you find the time to do that. But I wanted our listeners to know that, because, you know, you're always getting better all the time. Now, you've been successful at all levels, whether it be the college, the big league level, the Team USA, Team Israel, give our coaches around the world an idea of why, as a manager, what are the reasons you were able to be successful at all levels, not just at one, but at many levels. Give them, that way we can get a little understanding of this.
Well, it always starts with your personnel. Who's on the bus and what seat they're sitting in. You got to get the right people and put them in the right position, and then ask them to do what they can do, not ask them to do what is strategically or theoretically correct, but ask them to do what they can do. And then develop, you know, a trust relationship. I think that's, you know, that once you get your players, they got to know that you're there for the right reasons, which is for them. Now, certainly you're trying to win ball games, but also the individual player and what, you know, it has to be a win-win situation. Can't be just one way. And that's the case in minor league baseball. That's the case in college for sure. At Sacramento City College, our guys knew that, you know, we're trying to win ball games, but we're also trying to make you better people, better students, better athletes, help you get scholarships, help you get signed, and give you a foundation that not only can you take benefit from in your athletics, but also in life in general. And then in the big leagues, obviously it becomes more of a, the bottom line is the scoreboard. The W's and the L's become very important, but overall, unless you're taking care of and protecting the player and preparing the player properly, then the trust level is going to be very low. And then their commitment to what you're asking them to do might be not what it takes to have success.
Jerry, the big question always comes up all the time, and it seems to me it seems to be a very, very important one. You know, practice organization, you know, and we're talking about building a program, but practice organization seems to be so critical because, you know, I used to go to spring training at times, you know, and I was invited by some clubs to go watch or be part of some things. And sometimes, and this might have been in the past, it seemed like they were going through the motions. But, you know, I always wondered, you know, how do you get players to react to situations that happen in games? How do you prepare them for that?
Well, I think that traditionally we have not been as good at it as we need to be at every mm-hmm. level. I'm talking from youth league right up through the big leagues. And I think that we're learning lessons from, I think, college and professional football, the tempo at which they practice, the intensity at which they practice. Now, certainly they're only playing one game a week and they have a lot more practice time than we do on a daily basis in preparing for a game. Sure. But I think that I'll just give you an example. And this is one of my big pet peeves, more than a pet peeve. I just don't understand it. We're trying to prepare hitters for a baseball game that is both fast, mm-hmm. but also complex. It's fast in that you're reacting to a 90 mile an hour fastball. You know, you have maybe 17 one-hundredths of a second to make a decision whether it's a ball or a strike, and it takes, you know, 11 to 14 one-hundredths of a second to get your swing off, and pitches in 40 one-hundredths of a second. So things happen fast, but there are also some complexity. The pitch is in, the pitch is out. It's up, it's down. It's fast, it's slow. It moves into you, it moves away from you, it moves down, and maybe in some cases it even moves up with a low slot breaking ball guy. So now we end up preparing for it. We hit off the tee and the ball's moving 0 miles an hour. It has zero plane whatsoever. It's flat and it's always in the same place. We hit off underhand front toss, which I never quite understood. And the ball's coming up at you. It's slow. It's always the same speed. It's below game speed. There's no plane, always in the same spot or close to it. Then we take batting practice off of a BP pitcher. If he does a good job, there's no balls left in the cage. So basically he's aiming for your bat and you're throwing up a very low platform. So there's no plane and, it's always the same speed and it's basically right in the middle of the plate. And then you're and it's aerobic batting practice to boot, and that you're hitting every 3 seconds, and in a game you swing the bat every 15 seconds. So basically what, and then you go into the game after you broke all the furniture in the third deck during batting practice, and you roll over twice and pop up once and punch out once, and God, I really felt good today. I can't understand. Well, what happened? The game sped up, the complexity of the game sped up, and we practice. We're not comfortable being uncomfortable. So everything is feel good practice. And so we develop a swing plane that is unrealistic, because really hitting is the hitter matches his swing plane to the plane of the pitch. You know, the plane of the pitch is going to be somewhere between 4 and 12 degrees, depending upon how tall the pitcher is and the location of the pitch and so on. And so in practice, we never create that swing plane. And the game is fast. We have plenty of time to hit 60 mile an hour BP or a tee where it's going 0 miles an hour, or underhand front toss. And so our for me, we don't, and I'm not saying you eliminate that stuff. I think you need some of that stuff to warm up and get ready and to build a positive mindset. But I also think that we don't spend enough time practicing at game speed or game complexity. And you look at University of Oregon, the thing that struck me when Chip Kelly was there, and the speed, how they changed the game with the no huddle and how fast they were going and how fast they practiced and the speed of the game. And, that beats that team that walks through and doesn't have an up-tempo approach or practice plan. And I think that, we take ground balls in our preparation. And if you just time it, everything is like 4.8 to 5.3, and all of a sudden the game comes and that guy's running 4.1, and you develop this 4.8, 4.9 field throw mechanic, and all of a sudden now I got to rush everything at the end. I throw balls away, especially happens with younger players. And so I think that we need to put the clock on things. I think that we need to practice a percentage of our time at or above game speed. And I think that's happening. And you read all the time, like I read Beltran was talking about how he would hit off the machine, cranked all the way up at like 50 feet to get his eyes conditioned to the speed of the game. And I think that type of thinking is really, really important. The closer we can practice, now you can't spend 100% of your time doing that. You just get too beat up, hitting with that type of velocity. And plus it's hard to, if you got a pitcher that can throw batting practice and throw breaking balls and cutters for strikes and throw 90, well, he ain't throwing batting practice. He's pitching for someone in the big leagues. And so, finding ways to being creative and finding ways using the pitching machine, batting practice at higher speeds with breaking balls and changeups, and you don't know what's coming and that type of thing. A percentage of your work has to be more game-like, in my opinion.
Sure, that's outstanding. And folks around the world and even in the U.S. listening to the podcast, hope you're taking a lot of notes. I know I am. Every topic that we've asked Jerry right now, this could be a separate show on every topic. But I kind of wanted to, pick different topics that kind of built into a winning program. And I think, we've hit on some great, great areas, Jerry. Also, something that I think is very interesting is, being a manager coach is dealing with individuals and obviously different individuals. Give us an idea on how you, whether it be, disciplining players, sometimes you got to kick them in the butt. Sometimes you got to be nice. There's a fine line between all this. How did you work within your players in college or professional baseball?
Well, everybody's different. And, we like to say, oh, well, we treat everybody the same. Well, my philosophy was I treat everybody differently. It depends. Everybody has a little different personality of, and I make them understand early on that, my job is not to be their friend. I'm not, if you like me, that's great. If you don't like me, I don't worry about that. My job is to make sure that they accomplish what they are here to accomplish, and that's to make themselves better people and better players. So I'm going to tell you what you need to hear as opposed to what you want to hear. And then it's your choice to accept it or reject it. And hopefully, by the time we're in that process, that they understand. And again, after you're in it for a while, and there's past history, and they've seen what the benefits of the buy-in is, based on past history with players that you've had previously or teams that you've had previously and how they benefited by the process. I think it becomes really easy, and it's pretty easy for me when you're talking to someone. I'm not talking about who they are as a person. I'm talking about the choices that they make, and I'm not unhappy with them as a person. If we have to have one of those come to Jesus meetings, it's the choice that you make. And again, the response, what players don't understand is, they get very self-centered in their thinking. They don't understand the big picture. The team and being a good teammate, but also more than that. And I always have this talk, and we sit down. And I says, how many people are relying on you that are concerned about you on a daily basis? You know, your grandma, every day she calls your folks, or she checks out your Twitter account, or she checks your stats. And then, when grandma goes to play bridge, all her people there at the bridge, hey, how's your son or your grandson that's a professional player? And then they go home and their husbands ask them, hey, how's so-and-so's son, grandson? So there's a lot of people. Hey, your elementary school teacher, your doctor, your dentist, everybody is following you. So you're not in a microcosm. It's just not about you. And the choices that you make affect a lot of people. It's just not you. So they have to understand the big picture. And when they make a choice, is it going to make them better? What effect will it have on the team? Some people, when you put it in that perspective, it resonates, and some people are not comfortable with that. And you just figure out, the best approach for each individual. And again, it's very individualized.
Outstanding. And now what about this one? Here's a great one. Advice you can give coaches, how you handled yourself, in games when there was a physical error, a mental error. How did you react? What did you do? What was the learning process also?
Well, to me, games, my philosophy was hot practice, cool game. I mean, I'm very, 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 very demanding during practice. Mm-hmm. And then once the game starts, we just want, low highs and high lows. We want to be in that middle ground. Now, certainly physical errors, they happen, and we can address those, not necessarily during the game, even if, depending upon the physical error, if it was a positioning situation where you put yourself in a bad position based on your pre-pitch positioning they're not trying to make errors, but if you can correct some future errors based on some little things, there's going to be some conversation there. But it's never, you got to make that. Well, no kidding. I got being Captain Obvious. They know what they need to do. They know they need to throw strikes and catch the ball and throw it accurately. But if we can, some things that you can do to prevent those things from happening during the game after they happen, so they don't happen again. Certainly, there's going to be some one-on-one conversation, but very minimum. And then when guys break down, mentally in terms of focus or whatever it happens to be, those are the things that, it's hard to make adjustments during the game. If the mindset is wrong and that guy's not ready to play, then, my approach is we're going to get someone else in there.
Sure.
And if I don't have it, and sometimes you're painted into a corner and a guy is just not ready to play and you can't make a change, then I'm going to make a change the next three or four games to make my point so that he understands the necessity for him making better choices relative to his focus, readiness, the way he practices, that there's not enough transfer into games because he's not focused or the intent isn't good enough in practice. So you have to deal with those situations, but I'm not a not a yeller and screamer. I don't believe in yelling at the umpires. I believe in playing against the game. You play against the ball. I don't worry about what the other team does. I don't care what they do. You know, I'm more concerned and focused on what we do and how we respond to situations during the game.
And boy, do I love what you just, I love what you said, all of it, but I definitely love about the umpires because I'm with you on the umpires. I've never been one guy, you know, a guy to get on umpires. I see that a lot. I see it at all levels. And I don't know, I think it's just getting out of hand. But since you brought that up at the beginning of the show, you also mentioned pitcher, catcher, umpire relationship. Those three are very important. How, what's your advice to, you know, let's go back to the catcher and the manager with the umpires. Some advice there for our coaches.
Well, you need to have a relationship with the umpires. You see it all the time in the big leagues that certain catchers get certain pitches that other catchers don't get, and it's there's some physical technique issues there as well. But generally, as a catcher, there's very little discourse relative to, you know, that's a bad call, or, you know, we're not blaming the umpire. It's basically, hey, what can I do to give you the best chance to see the pitch and call strike? Because ultimately, the catcher and the umpire want the same things. They want every pitch is a strike, called a strike, because the umpires get graded down when they call strikes, balls, and especially when they call balls, strikes. And so they want you're working together, and when we have an adversarial relationship, that usually doesn't work, keeping balls in the dirt off the umpire. And I'm a big believer in that, even with no one on base, because the umpires will hang in there and do a better job, especially on balls, low balls that, you know, might hit the dirt, where they kind of back off a little bit. And if you block the ball all the time, keep the ball off them. You're always conversing with them in terms of setup and making sure they have a lane to see it, even though your number one criteria as a catcher in terms of setup is what's best for your pitcher, but you try and work with the umpire as well. And then you're also buffer between the pitcher, who, you know, body language many times will affect the umpire, and so you're the go-between not only the pitcher but the pitching coach and your manager in terms of those guys dealing with umpires. And, you know, they're not going to, it's not a game of perfect, and sure, they're human too. They miss pitches, but the better your relationship with that guy, you go up to the plate, and you don't have the luxury of arguing balls and strikes as a hitter, because that's going to affect your relationship with that umpire when you go back out there on defense. And truth be told, a lot of times catchers that have good relationships with umpires, marginal pitches don't get called on them because of it. And I'm not saying that's by design, but I think it happens sometimes.
Sure. And like you said, they're human beings. And, you know, what I love to hear from you is, you know, when there was a bad call, when you thought the call was made wrong, or, you know, rule's a rule, that's one thing. But if you thought a call was made wrong, explain to our coaches, how did you deal with the umpire, you know, when you went out there, if you went out there?
Well, if I go out there, you know, I don't go out there to ask them to, you know, they're not going to change a safe out call unless it's one of those, you know, where, you know, a ball up, a tag up the first baseline, and the guy calls him safe, and the first base umpire, and then they go to the plate guy and he sees the tag because he doesn't have the runner between him and the tagger. So he's, you know, those types of situations. But, you know, I don't go out very often. I go out very infrequently. You know, I ask them what they got. You know, I might talk about their positioning or their timing, and then it's over with. But I very, 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 very infrequently. I don't ask, where was that pitch? I'm not concerned. It was a ball. You know, they called a ball because they thought it was low, and I didn't think it was low, or it was in or out or whatever. And so, you know, basically the least amount of time you go out, the better, because then your players are focused on playing against the ball. We have a tendency, not only in baseball, but throughout society, of transferring blame. And if we win or lose, if the umpire doesn't get a W or L, it just falls on our ball club. And there, when we lose, everybody loses. When we win, everybody wins. And we don't tell we lost because the umpire was not very good or he made a bad call. Hey, there's 300 pitches in a game, and we're not going to let that one what we think is a bad call derail us in the game. You have to deal with adversity. You have to move on. And you have to deal with what's important now, which is the next pitch.
Absolutely. Outstanding. And Jerry, unfortunately, like always, we come to a time constraint, because I know the listeners would listen to you for hours. Last thing I want to do, and then I'll open it up and say anything you want to say to all our coaches, players, and parents around the world. You can pick anything, say anything, any advice you want to give them to end it. But the one other thing I want to cover, in all our shows, I've been adamant about this all my life, and I've been adamant on all the shows. I really believe that the foundation of the sport is what our volunteer coaches. I think it's the largest base of coaches in the world, and I say that because it is. It's a fact. There's more volunteer coaches in the world than there are of any level, whether whether it's high school, college, or professional. You have gone for us, the International Sports Group, a group that's been around for 30 years developing coaches worldwide. You've gone for us to many countries, and you've helped so many coaches. What I wanted to talk about get your advice on, how important do you think coaching is? I believe it's the most important thing because it develops the game. It keeps kids in the game. But give our audience what you believe, why coaches are so important, especially at the grassroots level.
Well, how important is parenting? I mean, what would kids be like without parents? It's the same thing when they're in a sports environment. You're acting in lieu of their parents. And it gives kids a sense of structure and direction. And basically, as a coach, we're not trying to make codependent players. The best lessons are self-taught. We want to teach people how to teach themselves, how to develop themselves. And, we're kind of like, just like parents, they can't be there and, oh, no, Johnny, don't do that. Don't go that way, go this way. I mean, kids have to make decisions on their own, but sometimes we act as guardrails to keep them on the right streets or the right highway. And so really, from the standpoint of structure and dissemination of information, that's why it's so important for coaches to have information. The man with the most information wins. Information is king. And if you're not a lifelong learner, and this is not only for coaches, but players, you don't get to the big leagues and stop developing. Because it's one of the few businesses in the world where someone's waiting right outside your office door, ready to take your desk and chair away if you don't perform. They love you win or tie. It's a very tenuous occupation, professional athletics in all sports. And so once you get there, you got to continue to develop. You got to continue to raise the bar. You got to continue to get better, because if you don't, someone's going to take your job away.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's a great ending. I mean, it couldn't have been said better. And what I love, I don't know if you can patent this one, but information is king. I love that line. And if there's one person anywhere in the world who has more information but knows how to apply it, I want to see anybody better than Jerry Weinstein. you got it down packed. And again, I'm going to say it again, Jerry. I just think you're a great role model for coaches because of, you're an educator. You constantly want to learn. Is there anything else you want to mention to our coaches and parents around the world? It's your 1 minute here. Mention anything you like, and then we'll close the show.
No, I think I've said what I need to say, but, you need to be passionate about what you're doing, and you need to be able to function when things are going well, and especially when things are going poorly. Adversity is a great teacher, and we can understand that we can do everything right. Baseball is a great. I just talked to my wife and I were talking about this today, that you can do everything right, and whether it's with raising kids or coaching, and still not get the results you want. You just need to understand that.
Mm-hmm. Outstanding. And Jerry, God bless you. I can't thank you enough for being on the show. Hope to see you soon, hopefully somewhere in the world or one of the international games. I always love sitting and talking to you. So again, thanks for being on Baseball Outside the Box.
You bet, Pete. My pleasure.
All right, folks. That is Jerry Weinstein. Listen, you got to do this. Check out his website, coachingcatchers.com. Also, he is on Twitter 24 hours a day. I get his messages all the time. They're just not messages. They're great learning. I mean, there's so much information. I can't even keep up with it. That's how good it is. Go to his Twitter at J-W-O-N catching. That's again, J-W-O-N catching on Twitter. Join. And also his website, coachingcatchers.com. And don't forget, we also give out some information. And sometimes it's also Jerry's information. Go to our Facebook, facebook.com/baseballoutsidethebox. Go to our website, baseballoutsidethebox.com. We're all over social media, at Baseball Out. Email me anytime you like, info@baseballoutsidethebox. Folks, this, remember, coaches' education is the key to building the foundation of our sport. So keep getting smarter by listening to the show that interviews baseball's best coaching minds. You heard one of the best here today with innovative thoughts that love to challenge the status quo. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Listen, have a great coaching day and love. We'll see you on the next show. God bless y'all.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.